watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. I'm Lynn Gary. This election season, corruption in government and in the electoral process are top issues for many voters. Anger and disgust over both major party leadership's refusal to end the unconscionable Iraq war and to take appropriate action to respond to the imminent ecological emergency has brought a flood of new contenders into the electoral arena who are challenging business as usual. They face an uphill battle. Vote fraud, gerrymandering, corporate influence, media spin. In short, a system so manipulated that it is a democracy in name only. We'll begin our look at the American political process this week with a segment from a new community radio special collaboration, Informed Dissent, produced by Pacifica Radio. It deals with corporate influence. So many nobody gets. All we want are open
minds, but that's what they fear the most. This is Informed Dissent, Pacifica Radio's national program, looking at this year's midterm elections and beyond. In this segment, it's all legal, corporate control of our elections. They say, EOS in a near state. We don't like your cat coming near our gate. Go back where you're from before it's too late. They say, EOS in a near state.
Well, the thing to remember in campaign finance and elections is it's not what's illegal that will shock you, it's what's legal.
Oregon had a good education system that was devastated by tax cuts orchestrated by Grover Norquist and Dick Armey. E-O-S.
We look at the ground-level impact of big money in elections, trends in campaign finance, and how activists are working to empower voters. Today, Lisa Loving from KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, reports on national perspectives and how big money shapes our electoral system.
Are our elections proof that America is a democracy? Or are they an elaborate money machine that rewards the powerful at the expense of children, families, and the working class? For the upcoming midterm elections, almost $1 billion in total campaign contributions have already been raised by congressional candidates alone. But the question remains, who wins and who loses? Pratap Chatterjee is the program director of CorpWatch, based in San Francisco.
Well, corporations exist to make a profit. And in order to make a profit, they need to be able to get projects, sell products, and therefore they need help from people in high places. Now, in many countries, this is done easily by slipping a bribe under the table. In the United States, it's a little more difficult because of the laws, but it's simply legalized as opposed to necessarily done under the table. There is no difference between what happens here or in other countries, except that it is recorded on paper often. You will see many instances of corruption and fraud, the sort of Cunninghams of the world, or the Abramoffs. Those are somewhat unusual. I mean, I think the problem isn't the people that are getting paid behind closed doors. The problem, in fact, is what's wide open. The fact that companies can pay for elections in the United States, which makes it kind of remarkable in the sense that corruption is so legal in this country.
That was Pratap Chatterjee of CorpWatch. This is where the rubber meets the road for corporate campaign contributions. As investigative reporter David Goodman found in his report for Mother Jones about Oregon's educational system, big business, and the ballot.
Well, the story has legs because, Oregon has, worked to sort of patch together and cobble together solutions to this problem. But the tax revolt marches on. And in my state, where I live, Vermont, there is now an effort to do the exact same thing. It's called a revolt and repeal movement here. Same deal. Digging into, cutting taxes, in particular targeting education taxes. I think the important thing for people to do here in every one of these cases is to look who these organizations are. Citizens for Sound Economy, as just an example, and they are an important example because they are a national organization. They describe themselves as an army of activists, and they also say that they are, quote, grassroots citizens dedicated to free markets and limited government. And you think, well, nothing particularly wrong with that. This is people, of a particular viewpoint banding together to advance their cause. But it's anything but a grassroots movement, because as you look at who they are, their funding at the national level comes from the largest corporations and right-wing foundations. So the major donors for Citizens for a Sound Economy are General Electric, ExxonMobil, General Motors, Eli Lilly, Cigna, Archer Daniels Midland, Shell, and Unilever. And Public Citizen described them as, rather than being a grassroots voice of consumers, it is more accurately, as they say, quote, a front group for corporate lobbying interests. The Washington Post detailed how Citizens for Sound Economy led the fight to torpedo a multi-billion-dollar federal plan to restore the Everglades while collecting $700,000 in contributions from Florida's three largest sugar companies, which had thousands of acres of cane-growing land at stake in that battle. CSE also took in more than $1 million from Philip Morris while it campaigned against cigarette taxes. So what these really are is front groups for these large corporations. And interestingly, Oregon's business community figured that out quite quickly. And so you had some of the major Oregon businesses, namely the Oregon Business Association, which includes Nike, Columbia Sportswear, Hanna Andersson, and a number of other Oregon-based companies, they fought this effort because they saw what it was going to do on the ground to their communities. So it's just always important to follow the money. You know, when somebody announces that they are a grassroots group, they spring up in your town and suddenly are curiously well-funded. It's a safe bet that that money is not coming from the neighborhood. It's coming from national organizations with a vested interest in this.
That was Mother Jones correspondent David Goodman. But there's more. Walmart Corporation is more than just a cheap department store juggernaut. A new political initiative by the world's largest retailer has a unique potential to impact the midterm elections. Wake Up Walmart Communications Director Chris Kofinas explains.
It's actually unprecedented that a corporation would play such a explicit advocacy role. What's basically happening is they launched this registration program a few weeks ago. They announced it, and under the auspices, they wanted their workers to go out there and vote. And when they were asked about, were you guys going to use this as a program, to pressure your employees to vote one way or another, they said absolutely not. And of course, we were suspicious then, but now it's been confirmed. And there was a story about it that was actually written in the Star Tribune in Minnesota, confirming where a Walmart executive confirms that Walmart is going to be playing an advocacy role. They're going to be giving their workers so-called voter cards, where they're going to, as they basically say, pay retribution on Democrats who dared, and I'm paraphrasing, who dared, you know, call on Walmart to change into a more responsible employer. And what this specifically is about is that in August, we launched this nationwide tour. We went to 19 states and 35 cities in 35 days. We got a lot of press, and we had some pretty prominent political figures, you know, former presidential candidates, current senators, people running for Senate, people running for governor, current governors, you know, people from all walks of the Democratic Party. In one of our events in Connecticut, we had Ned Lamont and Joe Lieberman both come out and speak out about the war, speak out about Walmart, for instance. And that's what was interesting. You know, we, you know, one of the folks there said the war divided them, but, you know, Walmart united them. And I think what's happening here is Walmart's decided not, instead of changing and maybe realizing we shouldn't pay our workers poverty level wages, not provide them with affordable health care, their response is try to pressure their workers to vote one way or another. And it really is a frightening thing if you think about it, because, you know, that your employer would take this kind of direct advocacy role. But even more so than that, the notion that Walmart is going to go out there and criticize Democrats for standing up to Walmart and saying you should pay your workers better and provide more affordable health care, I can't imagine anything more disingenuous than that. That is the role and responsibility of our leaders, whether they're Republican, Democrats, or independents. Their job is to stand up to the rich and powerful, and when they're not being responsible and say, you need to change, you need to do better. None of these candidates, I will tell you, because I was at all the, I was at every single one of these events, criticize, you know, Walmart shoppers, nor did they criticize Walmart workers, obviously. What they criticize, and rightfully so, is what is abject irresponsibility by a company that made $11.2 billion in profits, that leaves over half its workers without company health care, that leaves nearly half its workers' children on either without insurance or on public health care, and which cost the taxpayers over $9 billion is going to be the cost for the next 5 years to subsidize the health care costs of Walmart workers who are being forced onto public health care assistance. It is outrageous that they would think that that kind of irresponsibility should be ignored. And I think what you're going to see is a serious backlash by not only consumers but also Democrats, who are going to be pretty offended that in an era where you see this growing groundswell against the Republican Party, that they, when they find out, for instance, the truth, and the truth is that Walmart gives 80% of its donations, millions of dollars, to right-wing candidates, to right-wing causes, that is, you know, that has been a huge benefactor to, you know, this administration, and the ability for the right-wing Republicans to stay in power. When Democrats hear that, I think not only are they going to be shocked, they're going to be deeply offended that Walmart would get into this political game and try to tell people how to vote, and in fact, try to tell people to vote against their interests. I'm more than happy when people are registered, more people register, more people go out and vote. There's nothing wrong with that. And if Walmart had ended it there, that would have been fine. But what they are doing, and we were suspicious of this, and we knew this was a backdoor way of trying to pressure their employees, in effect, to vote against their interests. And what's ironic about that is, one, I don't think it's going to be successful. In fact, I think it's actually going to be, you know, counterproductive to Walmart, to say the least. If you look at the demographic profile of Walmart employees, you know, these are people who are, in many cases, working 2-3 jobs, working-class folks. A significant percentage are minorities. About 20% are African-American. I mean, you're talking about a demographic profile that is overwhelmingly Democratic. So an ironic twist, they're actually going to help Democrats win. And this is the part that I think is so boneheaded about their strategy. You know, instead of realizing, you know, maybe we do things the wrong way, maybe we should pay our workers a decent wage and provide affordable health care and help protect American jobs, and maybe we should change our workplace so that we don't face discrimination lawsuit and workplace lawsuit after another. Instead of realizing the wrong that they do and realize they need to change course, what they basically do is slap the American people in the face and say, we don't want to change, you can't make us, and we're going to fight all that we can to continue to be irresponsible. That is not acceptable. And that is why you think you've seen this movement of ours, the WakeUpWalmart.com movement, grow so significantly over the last year and a bit. I mean, we have over 276,000 people who've joined our campaign. It's one of the fastest growing, actually, it's probably the fastest growing grassroots movement today. And that's, I think, it bespeaks to something bigger. And what that bigger part of that is, that bigger issue is, the American people, both Republicans, Democrats, and independents, are sick and tired of what they see as irresponsibility amongst corporations who say they can't do better when they make billions of dollars in profits and when they shift billions of dollars of costs onto the American taxpayer. That is unacceptable. And that is why this election is so important. this election, arguably, you know, we always say this, and it sounds sometimes trite, but this is clearly one of the most important elections in our lifetime, because we have an incredible opportunity here to change course, not just in terms of change course in terms of the impact that the Republicans and the right wing have had, but even more so than that, change course in terms of the negative impact that particular corporations like Walmart have had. And that's one of the things I think sometimes people don't always understand. And I understand why, because you don't, you know, when you talk about politics, you tend to talk about, the key Republicans or the key Democrats and key figures in the party and so on and so forth. What we don't talk about is the underbelly. And that underbelly are corporations like Walmart that go out there and literally take the money that individuals go and spend, take that money and turn around and support the very right-wing causes that have taken this country in the wrong direction. I mean, you can go on and on, from voucher programs to right-wing causes to shipping jobs overseas to weakening port security to weakening wage and hour laws. I mean, it is outrageous to literally lobbying and pressuring governors, in particular Schwarzenegger in California, to veto legislation that would have made it illegal to lock employees in a store. I mean, when you talk about this company, it's something literally out of Dickens. And I think it's a tragic statement about how poor their values are. And that is why we have an incredible opportunity, not just to change our political leadership, but indirectly to change the direction of corporations like Walmart. And so at the end of the day, I think what matters here and how you can, in effect, defeat Walmart's right wing is by going to wakeupwalmart.com, joining our movement, telling your friends about why this election is so important, telling your friends about and your colleagues and your family members why this issue, the Walmart issue, isn't simply about one employer or one company. It literally is about what kind of America we want to live in. We can change this company, and in doing so, we can change America for the better.
That was Chris Kofinas with the Wake Up Walmart campaign in Washington, D.C.
James Madison, who said that in a democracy, you have to protect the wealthy from the masses. This remains true today. The only mystery is why Wall Street isn't called Madison Avenue. Not all the framers were pro-wealth. Jefferson warned about the power of corporations before they even existed. He was so anti-wealth that he died too poor to free his slaves. It's a lucky thing we have corporations and other wealthy people, because democracy is not cheap. Today, elected office is more expensive than ever. Corporations outspend unions in electoral contests 12 to 1, or even 24 to 1, depending on who you buy your statistics from. So it stands to reason that we must compel the unions to get permission from their members to spend money in politics, or we could take away their members. What have unions ever given their members, aside from the 8-hour day and the weekend, both of which are overrated, if not un-American? As President Bush once explained, throughout the 20th century, small groups of men seized control of great nations, built armies and arsenals, and set out to dominate the weak and intimidate the world. You can see that W does have his introspective moments. Some say the strength and vision of our corporations have resulted in the first truly worldwide empire. I prefer to think of us as a benevolent dominatrix. But if we are an empire, we are unique in that class. The world's first ever non-imperialist empire. Not that we're perfect. Somehow, extreme wealth and power seem to result in an increase in poverty. No one knows why. There were some who claimed to know, but they were convinced to know other things. But as a result of the economic structures in the world, it seemed that sometimes people are casualized, collaterally, daily even, through poverty and other quaint afflictions. This is natural. After all, companies love misery. Money may be the root of evil, but a man needs his roots. Some question this, but basically, you're either with us or you're with the euro. Remember, the business of America is none of your business. This is George Shrubb, sharing my point of view with you, so you won't need to own anything.
George Shrubb appears through the discourtesy of an unorganization which chooses to remain unknown.
Federal Elections Commission reports on campaign filings contain millions of entries every week. One nonpartisan organization takes that raw campaign data, crunches the numbers, and makes them available for anyone with a computer. That group is the Center for Responsive Politics. Their website, used by reporters, activists, and politicos alike, is opensecrets.org. I recently spoke with the center's communications director, Massey Rich.
Well, the thing to remember in campaign finance and elections is it's not what's illegal that will shock you, it's what's legal. There's so much money going in to fund U.S. elections because the candidates are reliant on private money. And corporations tend to have more money than labor unions, tend to have more money than the average voter to contribute to campaigns. And so, once again, in this election cycle, business is responsible for about three-quarters of the money going to fund federal politics.
I noticed that on opensecrets.org, you have a new feature about lobbying. Can you talk about that? What's new about it? What are you doing with that issue?
Yeah, we're really happy with this database because we think it's going to shine a lot of light on an area of political influence that a lot of people don't understand and really may only have come to be familiar with because of the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal earlier this year. Of course, campaign contributions, that's the money that helps the candidates run for office. Once they're in office, the lobbying really kicks in. This is the money spent by private interests, corporations, labor unions, ideological groups, others, to influence the policy. These are the hired guns that go up to Capitol Hill and press the case for their clients. Far more money is spent on lobbying than is spent on campaign contributions. So far in the 2006 election, candidates themselves have raised more than $1 billion. We haven't really worked out an estimate of how much money is going to be spent on the election as a whole, but just that's in a two-year period, that's fundraising. In lobbying, just last year was on federal lobbying was spent $2.2 billion. So there's a lot more money spent on lobbying, and it really hasn't been tracked very well, and that's what this new database is going to do, to really track who these professional influencers are and what they're looking to get in return. Just remember, it's always an investment. Campaign contributions are an investment. Lobbying is an investment. And it's an investment with a really good payoff. It is a small amount of money put in for what you can get in return through government contracts, earmarks specifically for your cause or your organization or business in legislation, tax credits, and that, other sorts of incentives and perks.
Are there any surprises for you at opensecrets.org as you put together? Your website is just massive in terms of data collection. It's also very accessible for just plain citizens that want to go there and find out, just to follow the money in their own state. But as you put this information together, are there any surprises for you for this upcoming election?
Every time I look at this site, I'm surprised by something. One thing that's surprising is just how much money goes into federal politics. We're not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. You gotta raise money to run campaigns. There isn't any public financing of elections, congressional elections, to make up for it. So you do have to lean on your friends and people who may want something in return. But just how much money is in the system is always surprising. One thing we just introduced on opensecrets.org is a new database tracking the personal finances of members of Congress. And we found that more than a third of our elected representatives in Washington are millionaires. They have net worth of $1 million or more. Now, compare that to the average American population. About 1% of Americans have net worth of $1 million or more. So, I don't know what the percentages is that we should feel comfortable with, but it is worth realizing or reminding ourselves that the people in Washington who are sent to Washington represent the voters and constituents are in many ways not like them. They may see the issues that they're legislating every day in different ways than their constituents do, and some of that has to do with their backgrounds, their own personal experiences.
Do you, at the Center for Responsive Politics, do you have a sense of the role that labor unions, labor is playing in terms of these efforts at campaign finance reform?
Well, the labor sector is a big giver to political candidates and parties as well, but they only account for a little over 4% of all the money in this elections cycle. I mean, business, again, is about three-quarters of the money going in here. But the Democrats have a lot to gain from labor. Labor has always benefited the Democrats, and that likely won't change anytime soon. They have, in addition to how much money they actually contribute to candidates, they do a lot of other election-type activity of getting out the vote, educating voters through their voter guides, trying to mobilize their membership. So they are influential, and generally, when you see some sort of reform proposed that would curtail the influence of unions, you see them in these strange alliances with corporations. Normally they would be on opposing sides of issues, but when it comes to campaign finance reform, they side together and are generally in favor of preserving the status quo and not taking a whole lot of steps that might curtail their influence.
That was Massey Rich, the communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics. Find out more about their work at opensecrets.org.
Residents of Madison, Wisconsin gave informed dissent their two cents on who controls elections. These comments are courtesy of WORT Radio in Madison.
In American elections, who has more power, the people or the corporations? We asked Madison, Wisconsin.
I think the people have a lot of power. They don't exercise it as often as they need to. So the corporations have more influence.
The corporations is the simple answer. The people certainly have the latent power. Just needs to be exercised.
I'd like to say the people, but I don't really believe what I'm saying. The corporations are the ones who have the politicians under their fingers, and the politicians don't really care about their constituents.
Corporations. I think the people can organize effectively as well, too, but I do think the corporations have a lot of power because of what they can buy with their vast wealth.
I'm sorry to say, but I believe that the corporations do at this time because they control what's on our commercial media, TV, radio, and our newspapers. And unfortunately, they do have control over voting machines.
I would say the people have more power, but it's which people? That's the question. I think the rich people have the power, and they own the corporations, which control the media, which tell the non-rich people what to think, because the non-rich people are too busy to do any thinking and too embarrassed to say that they don't bother thinking.
I don't think the rich people are thinking either. Anyone with foresight wouldn't be letting happen what's been happening. But I don't think the corporations can ever directly control elections unless the voting is fraudulent, which we have seen. People vote is what it comes down to. The problem is when a large percent of the voting population allows itself to be swayed by corporate-dominated media or rich people-dominated media.
At the flag factory.
I want to get some more flags.
We have more flags than anyone in the neighborhood already.
Not corporate flags.
Corporations have flags?
Some real beauties, too.
Ooh, the Nike swoosh.
We've got to have that one.
Why do we want corporate flags?
Corporations are the backbone of the country.
Corporations are global.
Backbone of the world.
I do love the corporations because they give money to the president so he can be elected.
I love the president.
I love the president.
Ooh, here's Martha Stewart's flag. Would you like that one?
I want war flags. Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed Martin.
I love the war corporations because they're so patriotic.
They are patriotic because they make money from the president's wars so that they can give money to the president so he can be elected.
We'll want these flags, too.
More war corporations?
Almost as good, because you can't have wars without them.
The World Bank?
Mm-hmm.
International Monetary Fund?
And the World Trade Organization.
These are great. Where are we going to fly these flags? The porch is pretty crowded, and if we try to fly them from our car, we might fly across the river again.
I've got a better idea this time.
This tank is the perfect way to display our war corporation flag.
And you get a lot of respect when you ride down the street in a tank.
Especially when the cannon works. May I?
Hey, let her rip.
I love the president!
I love the president!
Mushroom Cloud Theater. Informed Dissent is produced by the Pacifica Foundation and community stations all over the country. This segment was produced by Lisa Loving with Marcia Odom, Jessica Ring Perry, and Marlise Franklin. Executive producer is Otis McClay. Technical direction by John Almella and DeLise. Mushroom Cloud Theater is written by David Dozer and performed by him and Janet Coleman. Original music is produced, written, and performed by Sean Rhodes. Remember, it's listeners like you who make shows like this possible, so please support your local community radio station during Fund Drive. For Informed Dissent, I'm Mitch Jezerich in New York.
Rachel Treichler of Hammondsport is the Green Party candidate for New York State Attorney General. She's practiced law in New York since 1982. Here in the Finger Lakes, she's known in the community as a hard-working organizer who's responsible for bringing democracy schools to New York State, fighting water privatization, and promoting local farms and food production through the Farm to You program. Now Rachel is receiving national attention, not for the work she does, nor for her campaign positions, but because her Democratic rival, front-runner Andrew Cuomo, forced her exclusion from three televised debates after she had been invited to participate by the League of Women Voters. Rachel Treichler is not the first nor the only Green Party candidate to be excluded from debates. But because the League of Women Voters publicly withdrew their support of the debates after the TV stations barred Treichler, campaign censorship is becoming an electoral issue.
I think a lot of people did not realize that this happened. That things like this do happen regularly to third-party candidates. And as I've been going around and speaking to different groups about my campaign and talking about my exclusion from the debates, a lot of people have been very surprised to hear that I was excluded and have said that they think that was a terrible thing to have the Green Party candidate excluded from the Attorney General debates and also from the U.S. Senate debates here in New York. It's happening, as you say, in other states. In Connecticut, the Green Party candidate for governor who was excluded from the debates, he bought a short ad in the middle of the debate program to talk about his exclusion. And he noted that it cost him $3,000 to buy 15 seconds worth of time, and that the free time that the major party candidates got in that debate was worth $400,000 at the rate that he had to pay for time. So, you know, and in Washington State, the gubernatorial candidate actually got arrested for trying to get into the debate that he'd been excluded from. I think that as more Green Party candidates and other third party candidates, libertarians, and we also have a Socialist Workers Party on the ballot here in New York, as people become more aware that all these candidates are being excluded, people are objecting to this. And I really sense in this election here in New York, with the concerns about corruption that are coming out with all this scandal involving Hevesy right now, people are increasingly looking for alternatives. They're looking for alternative party candidates. So we just had a Zogby poll a couple of weeks ago that showed that three of our state candidates here in New York polled between 14% and 21% among independent voters, and that's about a third of all voters. So those are very good figures for the Green Party. That's better than we have done before. And I think a poll just in the last few days would give us better numbers, because there's increasing concern about the corruption in the state. People are really looking for new candidates. A number of people have told me that they told their friends that I was running, and when their friend heard there was another candidate, they said, "Oh, give me her name. You know, I want to write that down. I'm going to vote for her." So people are eager for alternatives.
Talk a bit about the corruption and what an attorney general would do and what you would do if you were in that position to address that.
Well, both major parties are dominated by special interests that buy influence with their donations to political campaigns. The influence that these interests have bought marginalizes ordinary citizens right out of the democratic process. The Attorney General has a very important role to play in stopping this. The buying of influence is against our laws. It is against the law to confer or offer to confer any benefit upon a public servant upon an agreement or understanding that such public servant's vote, decision, or exercise of discretion will be influenced. It's against the law to offer a bribe, and it's against the law to receive a bribe. Bribery is a felony, and there are also monetary penalties. And there's nothing in our bribery statutes that exempts campaign contributions. So the Attorney General should be enforcing our laws, our laws against corruption in office. We have good laws on this. An interesting fact that came out last week in the Attorney General debate is that Republican U.S. Senate candidate John Spencer filed a complaint with the Attorney General's office in 2003 when he was mayor of Yonkers, complaining about corruption in Westchester County. And his complaint showed that this corruption included the Westchester DA, Jeanine Pirro. Last week, when the Attorney General's office was questioned about this complaint, they have no record of it. They took no action. They don't even know what happened to the complaint.
What was the nature of that complaint? What are some of the specifics? Because it seems that corruption is very narrowly defined, or at least the laws are interpreted in a very narrow way, and people are not normally tried for corruption for making campaign contributions and that sort of thing.
Well, letter that Spencer filed has seven different sections, different problems that he had seen as mayor of Yonkers, and they involved in different ways manipulating elections. Some of them even involved running false Green Party candidates to try to split the vote and other things like that. It's a lot of different ways in which the state senator used their influence and power and working with people in the Board of Elections to manipulate election results.
Okay, so are you saying that Elliot Spitzer's office suppressed this complaint and didn't look into it? Is that ultimately how it looks?
That is how it looks. Elliot Spitzer ran on a platform of setting up a public integrity unit in the Attorney General's office, but he hasn't done much with that unit. And this is his office failed to act on this complaint. I have heard from other people in Westchester County who filed complaints against the developer in Westchester County for some of the favors that developer was receiving from different town boards. Filed a complaint about this, that the Attorney General's office failed to act on this person's complaint, and they subsequently noticed shortly thereafter that the developer's wife had made a substantial contribution to Spitzer's campaign funds. So there are issues involving what type of enforcement Elliot Spitzer has conducted.
Well, on the subject of what Elliot Spitzer has not enforced, I suppose you would call it a petition or a complaint was filed with Elliot Spitzer's office asking him to conduct an investigation into the facts of 9/11. And you had issued a press release saying that if you were Attorney General, you would initiate that investigation. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yes, I think that the citizens of New York definitely deserve to know more about what really happened on 9/11. A lot of evidence has come forward now in videotapes of showing how the towers came down that raised significant questions about the official story, that make it doubtful that the complete collapse of both of those towers could have happened just from burning jet fuel. And professors of physics and longtime experts in demolition technology say that they can see in the photographs of the buildings falling a lot of evidence to indicate that these were actually brought down by controlled demolition. So I think that's an extremely serious charge, if that's correct, that needs to be looked into. And we need to know what did happen to bring down those buildings on 9/11. There are wide ramifications within our state and in our country if the official story is not correct, and we need to know the truth.
Why do you think it is that Spitzer apparently didn't have the will to go forward with this, the murder of 3,000 people in New York City?
Well, I think that his reluctance to go forward with this suggests that there are very powerful interests that may be involved, and that an investigation into this might be stepping on the toes of very powerful interests. And I think Eliot Spitzer, working within the Democratic Party and other major party candidates, are more subject to pressure than someone from an alternative party, someone in the Green Party. We don't take any corporate contributions. We have very limited funding, and we have not been bought off by these powerful interests. So I think it's difficult for a candidate in one of the major parties to undertake an investigation into corruption, because they may be uncovering ties within their party, and that's difficult for them to do.
The whole system is engineered so that people don't have choice. It's very difficult to get on the ballot. Once you get on the ballot, then you have all sorts of obstacles in getting your voice heard to the same degree, in an equal way to people from the major parties who are just discounted. Could you talk a bit about some of the difficulties in being a third-party candidate?
I'll just say, to start with, that I joined the Green Party because I share the values of the Green Party. When I discovered the Green Party about 12 years ago, I was really excited to find a party that had the values that I believe in, and I have been active in the Green Party ever since. I did not know when I started to get active in the Green Party about all these barriers. I had not been politically active previously in my life. And so my participation in the Green Party has been a good education in our political process and how it works, and how it works in many, many aspects to exclude and diminish the role of third parties. There are many reasons for this, but one key aspect of that allows the major parties to control the party system has to do with our single-member legislative districts. Because with single-member districts, it can be gerrymandered, and historically have been gerrymandered to protect incumbents. And with the single-member districts, the two parties can work together to divide up the districts to say, well, you know, we won't challenge you here, and you won't challenge us there. And typically in New York, the Democrats have been given the districts in the cities, and the Republicans have the districts upstate. And in many cases, they don't run candidates against each other. The incumbent runs unchallenged. So a key reform would be to have multi-member election districts.
How does that work?
Well, research shows that a district with at least 5 representatives is almost impossible to gerrymander, because because there are enough representatives representing enough different viewpoints within the district that most people's voices can be represented in their voice. So you'd have multi-member election districts, and you would vote for the representatives from those districts with proportional voting. And this gives voice to minority positions and lets them have a voice in who is getting elected. With our winner-take-all system, we can have a party with, 50.1% in different places, and they can divide it up through election districts so that they actually control all the seats in the legislature. And that's not possible with multi-member districts and proportional voting. So that's a key reform.
Would there be then a larger legislature or bigger districts? How would this go forward?
I think you've identified the two ways to do it. Probably would be somewhat bigger districts, but could also increase the size of the legislature as well to provide for more representatives within a district. The state legislature would need to authorize this through laws, and it could be a constitutional amendment as well, go through a constitutional procedure. So it's something that the citizens need to push for. It's something that needs to be discussed so that people know what this issue is, know that there's a solution. People are generally talking about gerrymandering and setting up independent commissions or different ideas of how to draw these districts more fairly. But as long as you have single-member districts, there's a huge incentive to gerrymander. And any commission that's set up to deal with this is going to be corrupted because the power is great. So that's why working to set up multi-member districts is very important.
It seems there's a catch-22, however, which is that the whole purpose of the multi-member districts is to enable different parties and people with views outside of the Republican and Democrat sphere to broaden the range of representation and debate. But since those two parties now control everything, clearly they're not even willing to let someone from a third party debate them. They're the ones that have to pass the laws to make that possible, correct? Because there's no ability for citizen referendum in New York State. How could people get through this impasse to push forward some change like this?
Well, I think it's important to know for us to know what we're working toward. And you mentioned citizen referenda. That's another important step in democracy that we should have in New York. Other states have that referenda and initiative and recall. Those are three very important new laws that we should be pushing for in New York. So we need to start with what it is that we're seeking and the best way to achieve it. But then starting from where we have now, make sure that we have candidates running, multiple candidates running for all offices on the ballot. People should consider running themselves to create choice on the ballot. Studies show that we have far fewer candidates on the ballot now for almost every position than people in our country did 100 years ago. There was a lot more choice then than there is now. So we need more candidates on the ballot. You know, working within our existing election system, people need to understand that there is the option to do that. And once the candidates are on the ballot, people need to give them opportunities to speak and to be heard, to support them, it's going to take a grassroots effort of finding candidates, giving them forums to speak, and building alternative party structures that are open and democratic.
People often comment that there are many intelligent, creative, innovative people in America, and seldom do you find them running for political office. I think there's a reason for it. When you said, well, people should consider running, the first thought, in my mind was, oh, I'm going to have people prying into my private life. oh, I just really wouldn't like that at all, right? How have you felt about that since you've gone into the fray to do this, about that sort of thing?
Well, I think it is a lot of work to participate in electoral politics. It's very rewarding work in terms of learning about our system, learning how it works, and meeting lots of wonderful people that are doing this too. I haven't had the sort of inquiries and challenges that you mentioned that you know do happen when you run for office. When that starts to happen to me, I will recognize it as a chance that I'm really becoming a threat, because I think that it's not done to every candidate, but if you are challenging them in a very key race, or that it could be done. So one has to recognize that we're talking about very serious consequences here, and it's interesting to me what I have seen happen to the Green Party, which most people think of as small and not that influential, that the barriers that are thrown against us in every election to getting on the ballot show that even small, we represent a threat. And I guess this is one, I'm sort of a stubborn person, so when I see how much effort is put into keeping us off, I think, we must be onto something here. We must be doing something significant. We do threaten the system of control with the incumbents being allocated, because then the margin of difference that we present in the election becomes something that they can't calculate in terms of the support. So if we get any coverage, and even a small percentage of people vote for us, that percentage may affect the outcome of their winner-take-all election. So we make it much more difficult for them to control the outcomes just by participating, even when we don't win. We get a lot of pressure from Democrats about spoiling, because Democrats think somehow that the people who vote Green would be voting Democrat if the Greens weren't in the election. I don't think that's true. I think many Green voters are independents who probably don't vote a lot of the time, and they come out to vote when they see a candidate that represents their interests. As a Green Party candidate, you get a lot of questions about spoiling. And my response to that is, what kind of system do we have that you could spoil it by voting for what you believe in? I mean, doesn't that say a lot about our system? And I notice also that the people who seem most vehement with me about spoiling are Democrats that I think probably share a lot of concerns with me. And instead of seeing that the Green Party is actually helping our system to address those concerns by standing up and speaking for those concerns, and even creating an opportunity for them within their party to then push for those concerns, saying, look, the Greens out here are doing this, we should be doing it within our party. Instead of working in that way to forward these concerns, they turn on us. They turn on the Greens, who they share values with, and work to silence us. And, I think it's a very unfortunate dynamic that actually surprises me, that people who want to work within the Democratic Party don't take more advantage of the leverage that we give them by our activism in the Green Party.
All the political focus is on elections at the federal level and then the top offices at the state level. Local elections and local government bodies seem to have been relegated to, what's the budget to fix the potholes? What options exist to try to break through from the bottom?
Well, many options, and the best options really are, to get involved in local government, because it's easier to win those elections for any particular candidate. And actually, we now have 5 elected Greens in New York State, all of whom are holding local governmental positions. In our area, we have Rome Celli, who serves on the Brighton School Board. We have Mary Jo Long, who serves on the town board of Afton in Chenango County. We have there's a student at SUNY Cobleskill, Mike Sellers, who's the new mayor of the village of Cobleskill. And also in New Paltz, we have 2 elected Greens, the mayor, Jason West, who's received national media attention for his stance on same-sex marriage, and the deputy mayor, Rebecca Rotzler. And also there's a trustee in the village of Ellenville, Steve Krulik, who's a Green. So there are good opportunities to run for local office, and these are key offices. I was speaking with Rome recently, and he strongly encourages everyone to run for local office, and school boards, he was pointing out, have large budgets and are extremely influential, and it's very important to have a Green voice in these local bodies. It's very important, too, and as we're working to reclaim rights for local decision making, to have Greens in those bodies working for those rights. So I think running for the local positions is the most important of all, but running for the state offices and the federal offices gives us an opportunity to get visibility and media coverage that we don't often get for the local races. So I see running for the higher offices as a way of supporting people for local offices. And also this year in New York, we have the opportunity to regain ballot status for the Green Party. And that's something that we can only do by running a gubernatorial candidate. And we only have this opportunity once every 4 years. But if we get ballot status back, it will make it a great deal easier for candidates to run in all elections in the state, including the local elections. So the biggest benefit from our getting ballot status will be that we can run lots more local candidates. If you have ballot status, then to get a candidate on the ballot, you have to collect the signatures of 5% of the registered party members in the district. If you don't have ballot status, then generally you have to collect the signatures of 5% of the registered voters in the district. So that's a lot more signatures are required. And even for the major party candidates who have lots of party members in a district, the signature requirements for them are less than the signature requirements for an independent candidate. For example, to run for state assembly, the threshold is you have to collect 5% in the district or 500, whichever is less. If you're an independent candidate, it's 5% of the registered voters or 1,500, whichever is less. So right there, the minimums for an independent candidate is 3 times the minimum for a major party candidate.
What is the basis for such discrimination? Has anyone challenged that as a discriminatory law? Why should an independent candidate be required to have 3 times as many signatures?